The top stories. Iran fires ballistic missiles on the final day of its military drills in the Persian Gulf, a day after testing a precision strike cruise missile. Saudi Arabia intensifies its airstrikes on the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, hitting a stadium and an area near a hospital in its latest attacks. Also ahead, two major American airlines are forced to cancel dozens of their flights amid a surge in COVID cases across the U.S. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Our top story, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says its large-scale drills in the Persian Gulf area serve as a real warning to Israel. IRGC Chief Major General Hossein Salami says the regime's hands will be cut off if it carries out its recent threats against Iran. Salami says the Israeli officials should watch their words about Iran. The IRGC was holding the fifth and final day of its maneuvers in southern Iran Friday. The last day of the drill saw the force carry out simultaneous attack on a mock target by over a dozen ballistic missiles and drones. The force said the attack was 100% successful. A day earlier, the IRGC also test-fired a naval cruise missile with pinpoint accuracy. The exercises are part of regular Iranian military drills. On that story, let's bring in Mr. John Bosnich. He's a journalist and activist, as well as a political analyst who comes to you via Skype out of Belgrade. Sir, it's good to have you with us. Your reaction to what I just read, you know, the head of Iran's IRGC actually saying a few words regarding how these maneuvers will have to be interpreted by the Israeli officials.
Well, when you've got a country like Israel threatening military action against you regularly, the only possible response is to prepare one's own defenses. And Iran has made it clear that Iran is prepared to defend itself and also make counterstrikes against any aggressor. This is the proper position for any country. And in fact, the United Nations should have already intervened to warn Israel against its threats of aggressive warfare.
And, well, you know, in cases that it obviously does not intervene, the best course of action seems to be, I want to get your assessment on the course that Iran has taken in order to defend itself and its interests, and basically to talk with the language of military with those who are actually attacking, not attacking, but threatening with military force, including, of course, more importantly, some Israeli officials, as well as, well, you know, sometimes also the U.S. talks about, and I'm putting it in quotes, other options on the table regarding Iran.
Unfortunately, we can't really separate the USA and Israel, because Israel has such an incredibly high degree of influence in U.S. government policy, both in the Republican Party and in the Democratic Party, that Israel and the United States can be seen almost as one aggressor when it comes to Iran. The United States is also exercising influence on its European military colonies, which is what they are, through NATO. So not only is Iran surrounded and outnumbered by these foreign powers, but Iran has the best option of turning to its own supporters in Russia and China, because the world is tired of war after war after war run primarily by the military-industrial complex of the United States, but largely on the orders of Israel. This has got to stop, and Iran has made both the proper domestic defense moves and the international tie-ups with other countries which have faced U.S. and even Israeli aggression.
Let's imagine for a moment what kind of an impact do you think these words by the IRGC had? And of course, you know, just recent developments in Iran's military power, including the ones that were showcased in this recent maneuver, will have on the minds of the Israeli and on the words of the Israeli officials from this point forward.
Well, you know, in this situation, we're likely to see a reversal of the old David and Goliath story. In this case, it looks like Iran would be the David, and Goliath would be Israel and the United States. And I'm quite confident that one properly placed military strike from the defense forces of Iran could bring down the entire military-industrial complex of Israel and the United States. And this is what the advantage is in having the most advanced, most highly developed missile defenses in particular. Mm-hmm. The United States is producing airplanes that cost hundreds of millions of dollars per unit. And one well-placed, properly controlled missile can bring one of those down. Once those airplanes start falling from the sky, the entire aggressive tone of Israel and the United States will have to change.
Okay. And, you know, one thing that is really interesting to discuss, I believe, Mr. Bosnich, is that sometimes as officials of certain states and countries, you may show reactions that basically will have use for your own propaganda, for your own media, and for your own people. But deep inside in your inner circle, you know the answer. These maneuvers, and of course, you know, the idea of attacking Iran, how much do you see this to be the case that I just mentioned, you know, on the minds of the Israeli officials, the ones who actually know the truth?
Well, I would say that we're now getting to the point where defensive technology, especially interceptor missiles, is so well developed, and Iran is among the countries that have these defenses now, that the entire brute force, global bully attitude of the United States military complex and its partner Israel is facing a potential complete defeat. If that happens, the entire world would change. And I understand very well that the eastward drive of NATO and the United States and Israel could be and should be stopped by the combined efforts of not just Iran, but Iran's technical and economic partners in Russia and China. But I must say that there is nothing wrong and nothing that could be condemned about Iran conducting full-scale military preparations to defend itself in the face of open, public, and repeated threats of war.
Understandably, sir. Many, many thanks. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst out of Belgrade. You have a good day. Saudi Arabia has conducted deadly artillery attacks on Yemen's northwestern province of Sa'ada. Local media say the shelling left one person dead and 11 others injured. It came a day after Saudi aircraft hit a number of residential areas in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. One of the strikes hit a site near a hospital. The details on the casualties of that attack are yet to come in, though at least one civilian injury is confirmed. The damage caused to the neighborhood paralyzed the hospital. Locals were shaken by the strike.
The violent attacks hit the residential area in this street, causing damage to Olya Hospital and residential houses.
The Saudi Arabian strikes targeted my bus. Shattered windows are everywhere. They attacked when everyone was resting at their homes.
This is a residential area and there is no military base or camp around here. May God damn the U.S., Israel and their allies, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and anyone who targets innocent people late at night.
Saudi fighter jets also bombed a sports complex in northern Sana'a. Riyadh claims the target was a weapons depot. Yemen's Ansarullah movement, however, denies this. Following the attack, Yemen's Olympic Committee called on international bodies to put an end to Saudi attacks against sports facilities. Saudi Arabia launched its war on Yemen in 2015. It has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has given us the latest details on Saudi Arabia's airstrikes on the Yemeni capital.
In Sana'a, it's the place where I live. They were a few meters away from my house. We've heard them actually at the night at 10 and or 2 and 10 minutes p.m. or a.m., I'm sorry. We heard the bombardment, the windows broke, the tank of water broke. They targeted only a residential area, and it is very populated. There are a lot of people. I walked down to the street last night, and so the aftermath of the bombardments, the people there were very angry, as it is a very crowded area. There are thousands of people in that street. It's in the heart of the city of Sana'a. It's called the Zubairi Street, and all the world, all the Yemenis, I mean, know that this place or this area is a very populated area. So it was against the international law that protects civilian areas and civilian facilities. There were a civilian injured in that attack, and I believe that he is in the hospital now. Maybe he will live, maybe he will die. Most of the injuries, they die after a day or two when they go to the hospital.
Welcome to News Review. A Palestinian woman is dead after an Israeli settler runs over her in a northern occupied West Bank. The 60-year-old succumbed to her injuries before medical help arrived. The incident took place in a Palestinian residential area near Ramallah. It came hours after Israeli settlers, backed by regime forces, attacked a Palestinian village in a nearby area. The troops fired rubber bullets and tear gas, injuring at least 125 Palestinians. Israeli rights group Beit Salem says it has documented over 450 settler attacks on Palestinian villagers, or villages, that is, since early 2020. The group says Israeli forces did not intervene to stop the attacks in the majority of cases and often actively joined in. To discuss this a little bit further, I'm going to bring in Mr. Barry Grossman. He's an international lawyer and political analyst joining us out of Bali, as well as our own correspondent, Mona Kandil, who also comes to you live via Skype out of Ramallah. It's good to have you both on the show with me. I guess I'm going to begin with an update from Ramallah and ask Mona to fill us in regarding the latest information. Mona?
Well, yes, as you have said, 60-year-old Palestinian woman, Ghadir Masalmi Fuqaha, from the Palestinian town of Sinjar, northeast Ramallah, she was standing with her husband near the road in order, waiting for a taxi to pick them up. However, that road is also used by Israeli settlers. One of the Israeli settlers was driving his vehicle. He ran over the Palestinian woman and fled the scene. Immediately, the Palestinians gathered around the old woman. Then she was transferred to hospital, and she succumbed to her injuries. The Israeli military issued a statement saying that they are investigating the incident and that they don't think the settler ran over his vehicle on purpose, killing the woman. But all the eyewitnesses there can say that she was not standing in the middle of the street or even crossing the street. So it's hitting her on purpose. In the same place in 2014, a similar incident had taken place when an Israeli settler ran his vehicle over two Palestinian school children. They were returning back from school to their village, Sinjar. One of those children, female children, was killed, and the other was seriously wounded, and this has caused her disability. Following the recent incidents that what happened yesterday in the village of Burqa, when thousands of Israeli settlers went to the evacuated settlement of Homish in order to prevent the Israeli military to destroy some buildings there. There were clashes between the Palestinian residents of Burqa and the settlers. We are speaking about some 125 Palestinians were wounded, and not only from attacks by the settlers, but also from a fire by the Israeli soldiers there.
Okay, let's turn to our esteemed guests from Bali, Barry Grossman now to come in and please share with us, sir, your idea. How do you react to actually to this latest straight-up violence that has led to the death of this Palestinian woman, unfortunately?
I find it very difficult not to get angry on a daily basis. This tsunami of war crimes insofar as the so-called state of Israel is concerned, and murders as, insofar as the actions of individual settlers, is unnerving and beyond outrageous. It's always important to remember that this is the West Bank we're talking about. This is not that part of occupied Palestine where it won't be open following the aborted partition in 1948. One could argue unsuccessfully, I might add, that the Israelis have some claim to a modicum of legitimacy. This is the West Bank, and but for the Oslo Accords, the occupying forces would have no business there. And I guess what troubles me about this is we're seeing this happen over and over and over again without any concern whatsoever being showed by those involved that they might be subjected to a proper criminal investigation. Insofar as there are investigations, they're quite clearly done to create the appearance that the occupation is policing itself in order to avoid any kind of international action in the appropriate international court for criminal actions and war crimes.
And thank you for being with us for this edition of News Review. Two major American airlines have decided to cancel over 200 of their flights on Christmas Eve as the coronavirus pandemic takes a toll on their personnel. United and Delta Airlines say the surge in coronavirus cases nationwide directly affected their flight and other staff. The U.S. is facing a new surge in COVID cases as the Omicron variant takes hold. The government, however, has failed to impose vaccination requirements for travelers. The new uptick in cases has seen daily infections rise above 200,000 in the U.S. That has also caused testing shortage, adding to the traveler anxiety. Well, many, many thanks for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyrdom is the best deal one can strike with God.
This is the part of the speech delivered on October 16th, 2021 in a meeting with the officials in charge of the martyrs of Zanjan commemoration ceremony. The commemoration ceremony was held on October 28th, 2021. Martyrdom is the peak of glory.
There is a point here that we should all pay attention to. The point is that martyrdom is a peak, and a peak is not meaningful without a hillside. Each peak has a hillside. Many of us wish to reach the peak, but we have to pass along the hillside. We have to find the path on the hillside and tread the path to reach the peak. Otherwise, it is not possible to reach the peak without passing over the hillside. What is this path and this route? It is sincerity, self-sacrifice, truth, spirituality, diligence, forgiveness, attention to Allah, working for the people, struggling for justice, and working to establish the rule of religion. This is what determines the path, and if you travel this path, you may reach the peak. The one who reaches the peak must start from here and move along these paths. Spirituality should not be forgotten. I read somewhere that Marta Shahriari worked late one night on a complex scientific problem but could not solve it. His student related in a book that Marta worked a great deal. When he was unable to solve this problem, he said, "Let's go to the university mosque." I think it was in Shahid Beheshti University. We went inside the mosque and performed the 2 rak'at prayer and feeling and attention. After the prayer, he said, "I understand now. God the Exalted showed me the solution." He got up and left, and he solved the problem. This is spirituality. This is the way of God. When one makes this move and treads this path, it becomes possible to reach the peak. It becomes easy. I'm not saying that it will definitely be done, but it becomes feasible. Without moving in this direction, it is not possible to reach the peak.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united. The importance of holding commemoration ceremonies for the martyrs.
As for you organizers of this commemoration ceremony, first of all, you should know that this is a great deed. What is being done is a great deed. This commemoration of the martyrs and the work that is being done surrounding this issue should not be considered a normal, everyday deed. No, this is indeed a great deed that you are doing. Of course, it is a task that is not over. As this dear brother of ours said, it is not such that having held a number of commemoration ceremonies in some cities, counties, and provinces, the issue is over. It has just begun. Despite the passage of years since the time of the sacred defense, the job of commemorating martyrs has just begun, and it will and should continue.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Midstream.
Lebanon has always been a platform for freedom of expression and has always been a haven for the tormented, the oppressed, and the exiled. As soon as Lebanon is mentioned, its name is associated with all public liberties. Accordingly, Bahraini opposition activists found in Lebanon a few years ago a safe country for them after they had grown fed up with the practices of the Al-Khalifa regime, which is far away from humanity as can be. Bahraini activists sought refuge in a country full of human rights organizations and exercised their legitimate right to express their human rights cause. Back in their homeland, there are victims and prisoners of conscience who taste all kinds of regime torture without guilt or crime. Back in Bahrain, there is a regime that since 2011 has been practicing all forms of torment to suppress any political opposition. Fast forward to last week, members of the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society held a conference in Beirut that documented human rights violations in Bahrain. The conference did not appeal to the Al-Khalifa regime, so the Lebanese government was asked to take the necessary action. It is true that this is not the first time that this type of conference has been held on Lebanese soil, but the Persian Gulf state's insolence reached advanced levels after the incident of Lebanese minister George Qardahi. What was unfamiliar today has become normal on the basis that these tyrannical Arab regimes of the Persian Gulf view Lebanon as their backyard now. Paradoxically, the conference did not bring anything new or strange to the Bahraini regime. It did not come up with anything that human rights symposiums in Lebanon were not familiar with before. Perhaps the strangest thing lies in the Lebanese official reaction, which some have read as presenting credentials to Bahrain and Saudi Arabia behind it. Between Manama's objection and Beirut's response, which seemed more of a royal decree, two questions arise. What does the law say concerning the conference held by the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society? And how does the law view the reaction of the Lebanese government and its intention to deport Bahraini dissidents? It is crystal clear, my friends. The actions of the Lebanese government towards the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society are in violation of the Lebanese constitution and internal law, and are in violation of the rules of international custom and the charters of the United Nations, which prompted a lawsuit from a group of Lebanese lawyers who vowed to stop this illegal nonsense instigated by the Ministry of Interior. Yes, we are facing a serious incident in Lebanon that is not only related to the freedom of expression and state sovereignty, but also related to the official Lebanese response, which came as a political compliance to Bahrain's demands, mirroring the groveling of our Lebanese Prime Minister, who desperately wants the approval of Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. However, this is Lebanon, and this is unacceptable. It is forbidden to violate national sovereignty for the sake of saving face before tyrants. That will definitely lead to restriction of the freedom of activists and media professionals simply to please royal dictators who were not even elected in their own countries. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Lebanese Minister of Interior Bassam Maulawi requested in a letter he sent last week to the General Directorate of Public Security that all measures be taken to deport non-Lebanese members of the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society out of Lebanon. Well, please act surprised, but the Minister of Interior's decision came after a phone call he received from his Bahraini counterpart, Rashid bin Abdullah Al-Khalifa, in which they accused, the Bahraini's Al-Khalifa regime accused the Lebanese party of discussing this press conference held in Beirut as being unacceptable. Now, apparently, the Al-Khalifa regime in Bahrain were insulted by Al-Wifaq's human rights report published in Beirut, accusing Bahrain of arresting thousands of nationals arbitrarily, including hundreds of women and children, issuing hundreds of politicized sentences, and torturing hundreds of detainees. Now, can you see why the Bahraini tyrannical regime felt a bit, exposed? Well, to discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Adi Al-Faiz, Bahraini human rights activist. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Adi. Now, the Bahraini regime considered the Beirut, or what happened in Beirut, as a press conference held by Al-Wifaq party as totally unacceptable, and is, quote, a flagrant violation of the principles of respect for the sovereignty of states and non-interference in their internal affairs, unquote. Well, I would take that as a joke, but let me ask you that question first. What's your take on this official Bahraini position, and do you think it will really affect the status of the Bahraini opposition group inside of Beirut?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for having me in your show. I believe there are certain points that should be clarified to answer your question. We in the opposition are prohibited from practicing our basic political rights in our homeland, Bahrain. The political leaders and thousands of activists are behind bars, and others are either politically persecuted in Bahrain or in exile. The second point is Al-Wifaq, which represent the majority of Bahrainis, more than 60% of the electoral vote, as per the regime numbers in the 2006 and 2010 election, were for Al-Wifaq. This political party is being resolved by the regime. The current authority, we believe, the current authority lack legal, political, and popular legitimacy. Bahraini regime will never be able to halt our activities nor to crush the opposition. And we believe our colleagues in Al-Wifaq society, the members of Al-Wifaq in Beirut, have worked within the law and exercised their rights in Beirut peacefully.
But Mr. Ali, why did the Bahraini regime feel insulted that Beirut gave a platform for exiled Bahrainis who simply just reported about the fact that Al-Khalifa imprisoned women, they imprisoned children, and they killed detainees for simply having an opinion, but could care less about the official UN reports by international human rights organizations that prove that all that was said in Beirut was actually facts. It was not something being told to maybe expose Al-Khalifa, because they were already exposed.
Well, the similar report has been issued by State Department, U.S. State Department, by the Foreign Ministry here in Britain, by the United Nations Human Rights Council, and 9 years or 10 years ago, it was also almost the same issues was represented by Bassouni report. We believe at this point of time, the Al-Khalifa regime understand well that political solution is imminent. There is a pressure to fulfill a human rights obligation in Bahrain, and therefore they have to free the political prisoner and stop the human rights violations in Bahrain. And therefore, the Bahraini regime is utilizing any opportunity to wipe Al-Wifaq and the opposition. This is the regime dream, to wipe Al-Wifaq and the opposition, because at the time of the political solution, there will be nobody to have dialogue with or represent Bahraini project properly.
But look, it's no secret that all Bahraini activists who are part of the exiled people from Bahrain and others just fled the country to Beirut to find a safe haven for themselves and their families, where it's pretty safe for them in Lebanon, because they have an entire community that actually supports them and is ready to protect them. So since we know that no one really is going to get deported because it's against the law in Lebanon, then why is the Lebanese government putting this show on? For whom is it?
Well, we respect Lebanese, and we respect Lebanon law, and we believe we did not breach the law. We believe it is a political decision taken by the Interior Minister in Lebanon, and this political decision ordered by the Saudi and the Bahraini regime was a proxy only for this order.
But look, what makes me, as a Lebanese citizen, sure that no Bahraini will be deported, because basically it's against the Lebanese constitution, it's against our law to actually deport people who are taking refuge in Lebanon, who did not even violate our constitution or our law. And because it's a violation of the rules of international custom and the Charter of the United Nations, and Lebanon abides by these laws. So do you think Al-Khalifa might have a certain weapon that they might use to pressure the Lebanese government into probably trying to break their own law?
Well, I think it is Saudi mainly who play the game now. And this game, which is played by the Saudi mainly, is to escape their regional defeat and to fulfill United States and the Zionist goals. They are all, and certainly Bahraini regime, see Al-Wifaq and the Bahraini opposition as an enemy for their project in the region and in particular in Gulf. And that's why we believe taking such decision against Al-Wifaq and the opposition is not only for domestic interest, but also for regional interest that related to United States, Zionist, and Saudi.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Al-Fayez, Bahraini human rights activist, for joining us to talk about this matter. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Saudi Arabia's setbacks in Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, despite the attempt by the forces loyal to the Saudi Emirati coalition of aggression following the withdrawal of the militias backed by Abu Dhabi from the areas south of Hudaydah to try and regain the grounds of the western coast and to achieve breakthroughs in oil-rich Ma'rib, the counterattack launched by the Sana'a forces dispersed all these mercenaries. Now, this sparked widespread condemnation among activists who are loyal to the coalition of aggression. They accused the latter of betraying its forces. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is running from one Western power to the other to buy more weapons to try to compensate their successive losses, unable to fathom that they have already completely lost Ma'rib. You see, Ansarullah's control of Ma'rib would not only remodel the balance of power on the ground, but will also put the long-awaited peace processes on the right track. Successive Saudi setbacks in Yemen in this following report.
For almost 7 years now, Saudi Arabia has been floundering in the sands of Yemen. It is not able to resolve the battle militarily in its favor and achieve its declared and hidden goals behind the war, and it has not yet succumbed to the will of the Yemeni people and to the forces that defend it in the face of the defeats and setbacks that it suffers daily. Rather, Saudi Arabia keeps swelling with obstinacy and arrogance. It continues to vent about its failures by trying to harm the Yemeni people through daily massacres and intense air raids. For months, the Yemeni armed forces and the popular committees have been talking about the liberation of Ma'rib, and they continue to make new progress daily without any ability on the part of Saudi Arabia and its allies to stop this progress. In light of what is happening in the entire region, and especially what is happening right now in Ma'rib, with approaching a complete control of the strategic region and consequently the complete defeat of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and behind it the defeat of the Saudi project before the axis of the resistance in particular, it is just natural to expect an irrational Saudi bash using all available means. This was manifested in a continuation of Saudi arrogance towards anyone who disagrees with it while Ma'rib city approaches full liberation in favor of the Yemeni army and the popular committees. It can be also seen in the Saudi hysterical pressure for a ceasefire, despite the increase in American armament to Saudi Arabia, which depleted its budget. With a change in the equations of the war, which Saudi Arabia believed needed just weeks to win, Riyadh sought to conclude a large number of arms deals in an attempt to achieve technical and armament superiority, which was already available, but perhaps to compensate for its vast failures. Statements issued by Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Britain, and America keep reining in, stressing the necessity of a ceasefire in Ma'rib, claiming that the quartet countries are committed to, quote, a comprehensive political solution to the conflict in Yemen, unquote, simply because they lost everything on the ground. Meanwhile, fierce battles continue between the Yemeni armed forces of the Sana'a government on the one hand and the forces of Hadi and the Islah party, backed by the planes of Saudi coalition of aggression on the outskirts of the city of Ma'rib. Yemeni armed forces even shot down a U.S. Scan Eagle spy drone while it was carrying out hostile actions in the airspace of Wadi Ubaida in Ma'rib. Local sources also reported that the Yemeni army and the Popular Committee secured the sprawling eastern Al-Balaq mountain range, while they continued to advance on the fronts south and east of the city of Ma'rib. The fast successive events in Yemen suggest that the liberation of Ma'rib will no doubt enhance the chances of a lasting strategic peace in Yemen, as it is the last stronghold of Saudi mercenaries in the oil-rich Yemeni governorate. Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us. Ali, now almost 7 years now, the Saudi waged war against Yemen in order to restore what Riyadh calls legitimacy. It seems that the kingdom is experiencing some sort of a crisis related maybe to the futility of its procedures and its inability to come up with a radical solution to probably just shift the course of its aggression against the country. With all such resources, Mr. Ali, with all the state-of-the-art weaponry and war jets that can destroy cities in one round, basically, why did Saudi Arabia lose its war on Yemen?
Greetings to you. The main reason of Saudi Arabia losing its war on Yemen is the ignorance of the Saudi leadership to Yemeni society. Mohammed bin Salman, the current Saudi crown prince, when he began his war in 2015, believed that within 2 weeks he would be able to resolve this war in his favor, because in his belief, this would facilitate the process of his ascension to power and being crowned king, and even transferring this so-called victory to other Arab arenas. But his ignorance of the nature of Yemeni society and the circumstances that historically helped Yemenis win their wars and defeat the invaders, this specific issue led to Saudi Arabia losing this war despite the presence of a huge arsenal of weapons imported mainly from the United States of America and European countries such as Britain, France, and Germany. But this huge arsenal failed to secure a military victory for Mohammed bin Salman. Because, of course, the Yemenis are the ones who are defending their cause, fighting their aggressors. Yemenis are known to be fierce when they fight. Historically, there are many invaders who tried to invade Yemen and failed miserably. Great imperial powers tried to invade and occupy Yemen but failed. Therefore, Saudi Arabia is added today to the list of countries defeated in Yemen who failed in invading and occupying Yemen. The arrogant personality of the Saudi crown prince who refused to surrender to the fait accompli is what led to the prolongation of the life of this aggression against Yemen. I believe that as long as there is a mentality in Riyadh that does not accept the fait accompli, this aggression will continue not only for 7 years, but for 8 to 10 years and maybe more. All developments indicate that Saudi Arabia's last stronghold in Yemen, which is Ma'rib, have practically fell under Yemeni fire.
Paradoxically to what you just said, Mr. Ali, we did see the pro-Saudi media reporting daily about progress and repelling ground advancements of the Yemeni resistance, especially in Ma'rib, which you just said that it has fallen, and about killing tens of hundreds of members of the Yemeni armed forces. But the facts on the ground, as you just said, and the path of the military progress there suggests that all of this actually is not happening. It's not the truth. How long do you think this situation could continue, knowing that Saudi Arabia itself is not in a position financially that could help it to continue the way it is right now?
Just to point out what the Saudi media broadcasts and the media of aggression funded by Saudi Arabia, it's clear that when there are victories for Sana'a on the battlefronts, there's a discourse that claims and publishes false news about killing thousands and targeting operations rooms and destroying control rooms. But all this turns out to be an attempt to moral compensation for the military defeat on the ground. For days, there has been information and news published by the Saudi media, which says that there are hundreds of deaths among the ranks of Ansarullah and the Yemeni army affiliated with Sana'a. But on the other side, there is ground information indicating that the announcement of control of Maghreb is imminent and that a battle has been opened towards the Safar oil facility located to the east of Maghreb. These facilities are crucial and Sana'a must reach them in order to secure the energy needed to generate electricity and thus run the industrial and agricultural production cycle. Thus, dropping the siege of fuel ships coming from the sea that are used as a weapon of war by the Saudi coalition. In practice, Saudi Arabia is losing, and therefore, it's trying to compensate by spreading false allegations. But for the sake of time, how long can Saudi Arabia continue in this approach and bury its head in the sand like an ostrich and claim that things are fine for it? With the passage of time, all the lies will be exposed. I mean, lying about such issues has a narrow scope. The truth soon became apparent, and the whole world now knows that Saudi Arabia was defeated in Yemen.
But Mr. Ali, yes, they have lost. Their media is lying, and at the same time, Riyadh is seeking to conclude more larger numbers of arms deals in an attempt to achieve technical and armament superiority, despite the fact that it's there, but it's not being maybe used in the right direction. But for example, for the Americans, Saudi Arabia is spending 74% of its military budget, for Britain 12%, for France 4% of that budget. And all that money could literally have built Saudi Arabia and Yemen and probably other countries in the Arabian Peninsula. Why is Mohammed bin Salman finding it so hard to acknowledge the power and capabilities of the Yemeni forces and just stop and start a dialogue?
When Mohammed bin Salman and his father came to power in 2015, there was a cash reserve of about $730 billion. Today's cash flow is about $400 billion. These official Saudi figures may be less than that, in fact. I mean, Mohammed bin Salman actually burned about $350 billion in this war, according to the numbers before us. The actual numbers may be more than that. Mohammed bin Salman insists on continuing with the policy of buying, using, and employing weapons in Yemen because he wants to prolong the life of this war, waiting for America to change its opinion on the issue of direct intervention, to bring its own military or its air force to get involved in Yemen in order to save Saudi Arabia. Unfortunately, he is still counting on this matter. The statements of the lobbying groups that Saudi Arabia employs in Washington indicates the same conclusion. Mohammed bin Salman tried to count on Washington adjusting its strategy on Yemen to help him by recruiting its military directly in order to win this war for him. Therefore, he insists on the policy of buying weapons in addition to another issue, which he considers as a means of rapprochement with the West by continuing to buy these arms. As for the returns on this money that Saudi Arabia spent on its war in Yemen, it was possible to achieve not one vision, such as 2030 vision, but perhaps five visions like it, in the sense that this money was enough for Saudi citizens to live a life of luxury for generations to come. But Mohammed bin Salman chose to use this money in the war, thinking that he could achieve a military victory and be crowned as the militarily victorious king who wants to rule the region based on his Yemeni victory, according to his illusions.
Well, it seems that 2022 will be a very, very decisive year for Mohammed bin Salman and all his ruling party in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. I want to thank you very much, Ms. Ali Murad, political commentator, for joining us to talk about this matter on the Middle East Stream. Now, thank you, and please stay tuned next week for the Middle East Stream.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
Creator made Adam in his image.
Father and place the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint,
a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. And my guest today, as always, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Hussein, salam alaikum and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam. Glad to be here.
Welcome. And Sayyid Abdullah, salam alaikum. Welcome to the program again.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. In this series of programs, Viewpoint, or the movie critique program, we are mainly focusing on the religious concepts rather than the artistic features typical of so-called critical programs about arts and artistic characteristics of the movies. So our main purpose is to address those features and themes which are related about religion and God and whatsoever that goes with that territory. Well, today, let's start criticizing the movie 90 Minutes in Heaven. This is a 2015 Christian drama film directed by Michael Polish and starring Hayden Christensen, Kate Bosworth, Dwight Yoakam, Michael W. Smith, and so on and so forth, all right? Well, this is about a priest who's involved in a horrific car crash or car accident, pronounced dead at the scene. But 90 minutes later, having been brought to a hospital, he returns to life and claims to have seen heaven and visited with the deceased relative while he was there, while he was in a coma or something like that, you know. Well, before starting our questions and critique of this movie, let's take a listen to a part of the trailer, and then we'll be back.
I was the father of three children, the husband of a wonderful wife, a man with a great future. On January 18th, 1989... died. When I woke up, I was in heaven.
The man in the red Ford is deceased. I'd like to pray for him.
He's alive!
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah in the studio. Talking about and criticizing the movie 90 Minutes in Heaven. Brother Hussein, let me start with you, right? What do you think of this movie? Was it attractive to you?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Attractive? I wouldn't call it attractive.
Mm-hmm.
But I found it quite intriguing. You know, I actually like the interview they had with Don Piper more than the actual movie adaptation. The actual film was really boring. I mean, you know, like more than half of the film is just him sleeping in a hospital bed, I think. But the fact that the event happened, like in real life, really makes you think about, you know, when, where, and, you know, who miracles happen to. I mean, you know, how is the experience? And what steps would a person take to recover from, you know, that experience?
I see. Okay, Sayyid Abdullah, you know, this movie basically received negative reviews from critics, all right? For example, 26% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes based on 23 reviews with an average rating of 4.6 out of 10. Or Metacritic gives the film a score of 28 out of 100 based on reviews from 9 critics. So generally unfavorable reviews. What do you think?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, I don't blame them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anyone who watches the movie, it's like when you read the title of the movie itself, it gives you the impression it's going to be about heaven or what happened in heaven or what he saw in heaven. But 1 hour and 46 minutes to be exact, or maybe a little bit more, was just nothing about heaven except him trying to deal with his life story, which is not what the audience wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because this is not the impression that you get from the title. And so after watching for an hour and a half, you start to wonder, when are they going to get to the point mm-hmm. of the movie?
So
you would, through that hour and a half, you would naturally get negative reviews.
So what you mean is that what the movie didn't cover was the 90 minutes in heaven then?
They exactly missed the point. The only time they spoke about heaven was about exactly 5 minutes, I counted it, where he tells his wife what he saw. Mm-hmm. 5 minutes.
I see.
So out of 2 hours, 2 hour movie, only 5 minutes he talks about the experience, and that's about it.
Yes.
So imagine yourself in that, I don't know, in that a place where you're trying to get to the bottom of it, and there's nothing happening, and he's like, okay, where's the movie? Like, you're missing the bigger picture here.
Yes.
Where is the actual movie? Nothing is happening. And a lot of people, maybe they would even stop watching it, like, you know, after an hour, it's like, nothing is happening.
Yes.
You know, or they're trying to skip or fast forward to see what happens next.
Yes.
And nothing. So naturally, it will get all these negative reviews.
Yes. But to be fair, there are several concepts that were somehow intriguing, as Brother Hussein was talking about, you know?
About the heaven itself, about the personal life of
God? No, about the movie, the whole movie, you know?
Well, like I said, the actual concept is very attractive. A person goes to heaven and he comes back and he wants to tell you about it. And obviously, that's the only reason you would watch it, because you want these details, these juicy details.
Yes.
But then you watch the movie and there's nothing there. It's more like about life story and what happens between relationships and other things. Yeah, I can understand.
Okay.
A biography of the person himself. Fair enough.
Yes.
But if you want to tell me something about heaven, give me something about heaven.
Uh-huh, I see. Yeah. Okay, let's take a break and listen to a part of the movie 90 Minutes in Heaven, and we'll be back with more questions and critiques. Don't go away.
In January of 1989, I attended a church conference in the Trinity Pines suburb of Houston, where the focus was on the growth of the Union Baptist Church Association. I went because I was seriously considering starting a new church.
We know that God is calling to us to tell others about heaven and how to go there. The gospel begins right here, right where we are. And it travels. It travels to every neighborhood, every continent. And the prize that we shall receive is heaven. Amen.
Amen. Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad. Brother Hussein, let me ask you this question about this part, which is about the propagation of God's teachings through Gospels. And basically through, or wherever we talk about propagation or spread of the Word of God or religion, you know, mm-hmm. in general, we are talking about informing others how to go to heaven. And the prize is heaven. Is the prize of propagation heaven indeed?
Well, I mean, the act of propagating God's word is, of course, it's, you know, it gives you merits.
Mm-hmm.
God always says, you know, like in terms of Islam, for example, the person who reads the Quran gets a merit, but the person who teaches the Quran gets even more of a merit because, mm-hmm. You know, he's spreading the word of God. And the same thing goes for what you said. It essentially leads to going to heaven.
Yes, I see. Sayyid Abdullah, who tells other people to propagate or spread religion? Is it God himself that is telling them, or the idea is intriguing enough for anybody who's like familiar with a religion or two They like to do so.
All right, so do you want an Islamic perspective or Christian perspective?
Both, if possible.
It is possible, it just need longer time.
Okay. All right,
From an Islamic perspective, we have a version from the Quran. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Inni ja'alun fil ardi khalifa." I'm making a vicegerent, a khalifa, a caliph on earth,
yes,
which includes